minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step, Farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is the 15th of October in the glorious future year of 2022. Now, I have to ask, in what glorious future are miners still being killed in coal mine explosions? Because we had a report of that just yesterday from Turkey. 41 miners killed in a coal mine explosion. Now, it's possible this was a mine for metallurgical coal, but much more likely it was a mine for steam coal. As I've remarked before, something like half of the countries that use nuclear energy have populations smaller than that of Istanbul. So, as I've said before, I believe that there has been no case whatsoever for opening new large coal-fired power station since 1971, when the first Pickering unit came on the line in Canada. But, so yeah, and at the same time, Friday's Wall Street Journal, the back page of the front section, had a large, full-color ad depicting a supertanker carrying liquefied natural gas plowing through the ocean. Very bold. And the message from the company placing the ad was that investments in gas today don't interfere with investments in renewable energy for tomorrow. Which, in my opinion, well, if you think about what the message really is, you know, if they're wanting to put in natural gas export terminals, pipelines, liquefaction plants, supertankers, these are things where they're expecting to get their money back over a period of 20, 30, 40 years. So what they're saying when they say that investments in fossil fuels don't conflict with investments in renewables, what they're really saying is that they don't believe that wind and solar are going to take any meaningful share of the market away from fossil fuels in the lifetime of the people reading their ad. Right, because they're advertising to people who are making investment decisions, many of whom are 40, 50, 60 years old. So think about that for a minute, if you would. Let's see, little bits of information about me and my situation. I have a new desk chair. I paid $100 for it, which is really quite a bargain. It's a steel case, and I think they originally sold for something like $700, and it's only very slightly used. Then again, I felt like a real idiot. I went to an estate sale, and they had what appeared to be the very same chair marked $20. So I could have got it for a lot less, I guess, but you never know that that's going to happen. The place where I rent the storage unit had this large supply of these office chairs, and I'd asked how much one was several months ago, and $100 was the answer I got, and finally I decided I'd head it up to here with that creaky, squeaky chair that you've been hearing in my broadcasts for so long. And so I went and I bought and paid for that chair. So the fact that if I'd waited one more day, I could have got the same chair much cheaper, well, that's just life. Now, what I did, incidentally, I'll mention in respect to the whole natural gas issue, the stupidity of the European Commission sustainable investment taxonomy, I think it was. Anyway, the people who put it together originally refused to include nuclear energy on the weaselly excuse they said, well, we don't know enough about it. So the European Commission was asked to decide whether or not nuclear energy investments should be included in the sustainable investment taxonomy. So they referred the question to their expert research group, the Joint Research Center at Petten in the Netherlands. And the response they got back was that nuclear scored better in every category of the sustainability criteria than any of the renewable energy investments that had been explicitly included, wind, solar, and hydro, kind of, and biofuels, which are absolutely the worst. Well, the European Commission was very embarrassed by this response, which clearly is not what they were expecting. So they called for an independent review committee to check the results of the Joint Research Center at Petten, and the independent review committee, quite unsurprisingly, came back and said, yes, JRC Petten has correctly evaluated the scientific evidence. Well, at that point, the European Commission, in theory, was simply obligated to follow the recommendation of their expert body, but they didn't. Instead, the whole thing wound up being voted on in the European Parliament. Anyway, and they wound up tacking on this stupid rider that recognized gas as part of the sustainable investment taxonomy, which a lot of people pointed out made the whole thing quite ludicrous. Anyway. But, I've got a new desk chair. I also went out and I bought some, well, at an estate sale again, I bought some more recordable optical discs, so I don't need to worry about running out of blanks to make copies of Lunarcy anytime soon. So if you've been waiting to request a copy of that because you weren't sure whether I had enough, the answer is I do. So that's all right. Then the other thing that I bought while I was out was the chemicals for making cyanotypes. And so I'm going to start experimenting with the various kinds of paper that I have to see what stands up well to being treated and gives a good result in the end. I'm hoping I can find something that's flat. You know, I've got a lot of onion skin typing paper, which might actually work, but tends to have a kind of a crinkly texture. Anyway, so we'll see what happens with that. I hope to be making some experimental cyanotypes soon. Of course, if the house collapses because the plumbers haven't come back and it rains a thunderstorm and so on, I don't know what I'm going to do. So, yeah, the house, there's still a big mound of dirt in the backyard and a big mound of dirt in the front yard and a tunnel under the house, which is apparently not shored up with pit props or anything. And anyway, I'm just very worried. We're supposed to have thunderstorms Sunday night, and I'm worried that the foundation is going to collapse and the house will implode. And where do I keep my stuff? Where am I supposed to live if my house falls in? Anyway, so that's the matter of me. But last time I got to talking about immigration policies and the Australian immigration policy that lasted into the 1960s, where if you were in Britain and you were white and you spoke English and you had £5 sterling in your pocket, you could emigrate to Australia. Now, skipping over the Australian government's perhaps somewhat ridiculous racial purity policies, which were to a great extent influenced by their fear of being flooded with Malaysians and Indonesians and that sort of people from much closer countries than Britain. I just keep thinking about the context of immigration and emigration in terms of space colonies, right? Because there's so many things at work here. For example, if you're in the United States today and you see a Chinese or Indian person, you're liable to think this person is a member of the professional class, an educated person, or at least a small businessman, right? That in the 19th century, there was a great deal of anger and resentment and lots of noise over Orientals, particularly, being brought to United States, Canada, other places like that as coolie laborers, just, you know, illiterate peasants being brought in as cheap labor, for example, to work on railways. And one of the curious consequences You know, Woodrow Wilson with his League of Nations, with its International Migration Organization, International Labor Organization, which really put the clamps down on the free movement of people across international borders, which had been the norm before the First World War. And then the extreme racist immigration legislation, very explicitly racist immigration legislation of the Harding administration, have had this curious side effect that when you see someone who definitely looks like what you expect an immigrant to look like, what someone who, you know, you expect that person to be well-to-do, to be a member of the professional class or a small businessman, to be well-educated, and so on. That's an interesting byproduct. While, of course, you know, in America, the stereotype continues to be that, well, you know, if that person looks like a Mexican and Mexicans are all, you know, a bunch of lazy layabouts, yeah, right. I mean, they, you know, they're talking about people who will leave behind everything that they've ever known and go through considerable difficulties, long distances, to take shitty, poorly paid jobs because there's something about it that makes them think that they're going to get ahead in life by doing that. You're talking about somebody with a great deal of initiative, a great deal of courage. So don't be so quick to dismiss them, is what I'm saying. Even if they are not well-educated, right? Even if they are not affluent, they've got, by and large, a lot of initiative, a lot of spirit. I've said before that I sometimes think the United States immigration policy with regard to Mexico has been intended to siphon off the ambitious lower-class Mexicans, but put enough difficulties in their way that they're always struggling so that they don't go back to Mexico and start another revolution there. And I don't know if that's ever been the explicit purpose, but it does seem to be part of the way it works. But I do keep thinking about this. You know, I keep thinking about, for example, in Britain in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, when the punishment for a variety of what we would consider petty offenses was transportation. In other words, they would take you away to Georgia or to New South Wales, Australia. And I've always wondered, how many people, do you suppose, committed those kinds of crimes in order to be transported? Because the life of a convict transportee was a brutal one, to be sure, you know. But on the other hand, the life of the working class in late 18th, early 19th century Britain was brutal, too. You know, people were forging one-pound notes to get by in life, despite the numerous, very public hangings, which inspired a very famous editorial cartoon by Cruikshank. You know, you could be put to death for forging a pound note, and yet people did it all the time. That was how tough life was for the working classes at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century in Britain. So the thought that you were going to be, you know, for stealing a loaf of bread, you were going to be put on a ship, sent all the way around the world to Australia, you know, and then kept in a penal colony for 3 or 5 years, and then just sort of released into the wild. Well, I suppose there were quite a number of people for whom that sounded better than the deal they had. But I, you know, as I say, I'm constantly thinking about movement to space settlements. And, you know, I mean, Robert Heinlein, of course, wrote a novel, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, in which the price of space transportation was low enough that the governments of Earth had decided to use the moon as a penal colony. Well, that seems unlikely overall as a scenario. But on the other hand, I would expect all manner of disaffected people to want to emigrate from Earth. I mean, this is the thing. I wonder how many of these folks who are engaged in, you know, super capitalistic practices. They've got into the venture capital firms and whatever, and they're disrupting everything in sight. I wonder how many of them are doing this actually out of a profound dissatisfaction with the world as it is, and this is simply the only way that they've been taught right how to change things, is you get into capitalism and you try to destroy other people's businesses, and maybe then you can build the kind of world you want to live in. The problem is, I look at this, and of course I think, well, you know, I don't want murderers emigrating to my space colony. What kind of murderers are likely to emigrate to my space colony? Well, I think of Leopold and Loeb, who back in the 1920s, a couple of prep school kids who decided that because their fathers were rich, that meant that they were a superior stratum of humanity who could treat other people like cattle. And so they went and brutally murdered another teenager in the sublime belief that they wouldn't get caught because they, you know, they would get away with it because they were better than other people. And I'm sorry to say that sometimes, you know, Bezos and Musk look to me like Leopold and Loeb. You know, that's just how it looks to me. And when they talk about building the world that they want to see, well, I look at the world that they actually are building, right? The thing is, Amazon's fulfillment centers and warehouses, right, their labor practices, don't fill me with confidence about what kind of a world Jeff Bezos would want to build, because he doesn't seem to believe in the seamless garment, right? I don't know exactly what's going on here. You know, does he believe in the Marxist revolution that if you just make things bad enough for the working class, then we will have the revolution and everything will be perfect? What's going on there? Because the thing that he's actually creating in the world doesn't match the kind of idealism that goes with space settlement. And frankly, Elon Musk and his proposal to essentially transport people to Mars as indentured servants, you know, well, you'll borrow the money on Earth and then you'll work it off on Mars. You know, no. No. This is not how you build the good world. This is not how you build the world we want.
Let's see, looking in calm.
But, you know, when I first heard that proposal, I said, you know, I've read this story before. The title is Logic of Empire. It was written by Robert Heinlein 70-plus years ago. And it's not a pleasant story. He had a couple of drafts for ones that were worse that he never did write. Anyhow, so, I don't know if I have any conclusions to draw about that. You know, I'm certain, you know, Peter Cook is right when he says that people who were contented in England mostly didn't move to the New World, and people who were contented in Boston and Baltimore didn't go to the West, which was in those days Chicago, and people who were contented in Chicago and St. Louis didn't go to Oregon and California. You know, I'm sure he's right about that. The thing is, of course, that space settlement offers us two great new opportunities that have never really existed before in the history of human settlement on Earth. And that is to say, they haven't existed in the period of time we would call historical. And the first is something of a blank slate, in the sense that you go to the asteroids, you go to the moon, you go to Mars, you go to the satellites of Jupiter, and there's not other people living there, right? So you don't have that conflict which, you know, many people try to sort of frame as the central historical conflict these days of indigenous versus colonizers. And of course, you see this sometimes presented in really quite questionable ways. As an example, you know, the apartheid in South Africa, often framed as indigenous versus colonizers. Well, as anybody who cares to know knows, you know, the Europeans and the Bantu peoples, the Zulu and Xhosa and so forth, showed up in the territory of what's now South Africa about the same time. The Europeans from the seaports in the south and the Bantus from the north. And the actual indigenous people there are the, well, they have various names. The old European names are things like Hottentots and Bushmen, which I suppose many people consider insulting these days, but I very much doubt those people are listening to this program. You know, there's very few San or Kung or Herero or any of those folks listening to this program. And so I might as well use the names that people are more likely to recognize. But suffice to say that both groups of people, the Dutch and the Bantu, treated them in the same way. Namely, they enslaved them or they killed them. The fact being that hunter-gatherers, without any particular sense of property, get treated as cattle thieves. Very same thing with the indigenous Australians and so on, right? Because people who are hunter-gatherers don't necessarily have the sense that this large animal is the property of someone. This large animal is, you know, has been carefully tended by someone, and they won't appreciate it if you kill it and eat it. And so both the Dutch and the Bantu, who were, frankly, for a very, very long time, quite evenly matched, you know, they would come in conflict and one or the other would get the upper hand. But they were always, both of them, either killing or enslaving or driving away the actual indigenous people there. But suffice to say, we don't face that in the field of extraterrestrial settlement and colonization. Right. The solar system, there are some prospects for life elsewhere in the solar system, but it's very unlikely that that kind of conflict will arise. Now, Robert Zubrin, who likes to take extreme positions, has claimed that it would be immoral not to exterminate whatever Martian life exists, which he's thinking is microbial, if that makes the planet more habitable for humans. I think that thinking in terms of trying to make Mars more habitable for humans is stupid. It's a small planet, and considering what small proportion of this Earth is habitable for humans, Mars, which is far enough away from the sun that it gets only half as much sunlight, is unlikely to be more than a very arid, hard-scrabble existence. So why bother when you can build Island 3 in the O'Neill terms, right? Why bother when you can build various kinds of free space or asteroidal habitats, non-planetary habitats, with a tailored environment? But again, the thing is, the solar system is very, very large. You know, just forget going to the nearest star. The fact is, our solar system is colossal. And so it's entirely feasible, considering that there are many, many, many mineral-bearing bodies in the main belt asteroids, in the Trojan and Greek points of Jupiter, and so on. And considering that there are many, many orbits which get about as much solar energy as each other and just don't conflict, it's entirely possible to have communities, right, human settlements that are far away from each other and don't necessarily interact. They don't have to interact. They don't have borders on one another. Because, of course, the American West in the 19th century, there were always communities of people going west to try to set up a town or a settlement or whatever they thought, where they were going to live life the way they thought it should be lived, without the contamination and pollution from other groups of people who lived a different way, which is what they, as they saw it, made it difficult to live the way that they thought should be lived. Well, of course, the thing is that most of these settlements were overtaken. You know, even Great Salt Lake, right, even the Mormon settlements in Utah eventually were exposed to the outside world and had to deal with the outside world, and that changed the character of their settlements. So, the plain fact is, as I see it, nobody on Earth has ever had a particularly good chance, not in several thousand years, of setting up a utopian community with a totally new way of living, and living according to their own lights, without having to have contact with people who lived in very different ways. And space settlement gives us that opportunity. Now, my opinion? Most such settlements will probably fail. Fail rapidly, fail catastrophically. You know, the New England Puritans, they went to the New World with very specific ideas how life ought to be, and by the time their grandchildren were running the show, those ideas had largely been abandoned, because ideological purity, as it turns out, is a relatively difficult thing to pass down from one generation to another. And of course, there are many people whose schemes simply didn't work. Transcendental Wild Oats by Louisa May Alcott is a story, it's a reminiscence, of her father's attempt to create a utopian commune in New England, which was an absolute failure, because you had a bunch of merchants from the town who were going to grow their own food, etc., and they didn't know the first thing about it. The only reason they didn't starve to death was that a real eccentric came and visited them and helped them through the winter. Guy with a beard, in the curious book Forgotten Men of American History, is described as possibly the only white man with a beard between the Atlantic and the Appalachians in the 1820s. So I think most of these utopian settlements and so on, utopian communities, will fail in some way or other. Fairly rapidly, fail fairly hard. But they have a chance to succeed, a chance to experiment with really new ways of doing things without having to have a revolution, right? Without having to overthrow an existing system, etc., which nobody has had in a very, very long time. Not perhaps since the Polynesians were settling the islands of the Pacific. And of course, the Polynesians were extremely resource constrained. You know, the last major Polynesian settlement was Aotearoa, as it's really known. It's a modern term, New Zealand. There are older Maori terms for what we call New Zealand. Aotearoa is really one that was adopted in the late 19th, early 20th century over a number of others. But the Maori, right, Polynesians who went south rather than east. And when Europeans arrived, about 700 years later, what did they find? Well, the main thing they found was the Maori had rapidly driven most of the large birds, the moa and so on, that had populated the island, had driven them to extinction. Supposedly, there were elderly Maori alive when the first Europeans arrived who still remembered the last moa hunts. But the Maori had significantly shifted the ecological balance, which, again, people do wherever they go. We've been doing it a long time. There's evidence that the extinction of some of the Ice Age megafauna was due to human activity, not climate changes. So, you know, again, anybody who tells you the indigenous peoples lived in peace with each other and the land until the white men came doesn't know anything about it. The plain fact is, you know, the Maori were divided into a lot of groups who conducted extremely brutal warfare against each other. But they were good enough at it that, unlike most of the indigenous groups other places that European colonizers came, they succeeded in making a single treaty and have, you know, a still significant influence in what happens in New Zealand. Anyway, I didn't get to my other topic for today, which was the importance of curiosity and play in the natural sciences. But you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnonRadio.net, a service of the public SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. And coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. And incidentally, if you want to support these broadcasts, you can send money to paypal.me/prometheuslives.
7, 6.